Welcome to Financial Planning for Oil and Gas Professionals, hosted by certified financial planners Justin Brownlee and Jared Machen of Brownlee Wealth Management, the only podcast dedicated to those of you in the oil and gas profession to help you optimize investments, lower future taxes, and grow your wealth. Learn more and subscribe today at BrownleeWealthManagement.com.
Welcome back to another episode of FPOG, Financial Planning for Oil and Gas Professionals. This week on the podcast, we're excited to welcome Preston Holland to our podcast. What we want to talk about today is a little bit of an outside of the box topic. We want to dive into the world of private jets, private airplanes. So when it comes to private aviation, is this directly related to tax and estate planning for oil and gas professionals? Well, yes and no. It's a little bit of a tangent topic, but it also has a lot of overlap with our listeners and our niche. And so with that being said, Preston, welcome to the show. We're excited to have you.
Justin, thanks for having me. I'm super excited to be able to sit here and have a good conversation about private aviation. You know, I think that the oil and gas industry is a big user of private aviation. It you know, helps support hundreds of jobs across the state of Texas and across the world in private aviation. So I'm excited to, you know, kind of give a little bit of an insider view into, what, you know, makes our industry tick, how our industries overlap together. And this is going to be a lot of fun.
I love that. That's absolutely right. Preston, if you don't mind, would love to just hear a little bit about yourself and how you entered the private aviation space.
Yeah. So my name is Preston Holland. I'm the Chief Commercial Officer at Flying Finance. We are an aviation finance company. Basically, we help individuals and corporations purchase aircraft and finance them in the acquisition process. I started out, the way that I got into private aviation was I actually ran a magazine. So I ran a media business for about 2.5 years. I had a friend of mine said, "Hey, I'm buying Flying Magazine," and we ran a private equity style roll up of, you know, about 28 different aviation titles over the course of about 2.5 years. And so I led the charge over there as chief operating officer. You know, was in charge of all of the day to day of the company and a lot of the integration. We had we still do have a strategy team, and we acquired an aviation finance business. And as a part of that transition, I was tapped by our executive team and our board to go kind of branch off and run that. I was, you know, pretty well connected in the industry and, you know, was you know, ready kind of for the next adventure. And so moved over into that sometime last year and, you know, have really been having a good time, you know, getting to meet a lot of really interesting people from all different walks of life, you know, kind of across the spectrum, helping them acquire airplanes and make that purchase.
That's very cool. And we will, in the show notes, we will link your X account. We'll link your social media so that our listeners can follow you. But Preston, you've been on a pretty significant rise recently. So I'm interested to just hear, you know, so many more people are interacting with your content. What has this felt like for you? And what does it say about private aviation that what you're putting out there is so compelling?
Yeah, listen, Justin, it's pretty cool. I've been on Twitter for, gosh, I don't know, 5 or 6 years probably. I started out kind of tweeting business process stuff. And so I connected. I was blessed to interact with some pretty major accounts on kind of call it business Twitter early on, and before they, you know, kind of became, you know, these huge accounts. Chris Powers, who's there in Fort Worth with you, Fort Worth Chris, you know, I think we followed each other. He had 3,500 followers. He's got, you know, 60 something thousand. Sweaty Startup is another one. It's funny. Everybody's like, "Oh yeah." I was like, "I know Nick. I've, you know, hung out with Nick before, you know, followed me when he had 20,000. He's got 330,000 followers now." But I tweet business process stuff and, you know, things I was thinking about. You know, I actually was recruited to Flying based off of my Twitter account, which was, you know, at the time a 1,400 follower, you know, call it, you know, super sub niche tweeting about business process stuff. And, you know, when I started in this space, I tweet a little bit about what I did, you know, in the private aviation space, and, you know, I tweet pictures of airplanes or whatever. And, you know, I'd start getting these DMs that were like, hey, you know, I need a charter from the Northeast of Florida, or like, hey, I am thinking about a fractional card, you know, what should I be thinking about? And the world of private aviation is so opaque, and I'm going to be honest with you, it's intentional by a lot of the actors. For instance, you can't find NetJets pricing on NetJets.com. And actually, me as an individual inside the private aviation industry, I can't even get their sales reps to give me pricing. And I'm like, guys, I read a newsletter. Like, I have actual people considering swapping to NetJets. I can write about the pricing, and you're going to, you know, you're going to have five or six people reach out. So, I started tweeting the real cost behind private aviation, my account started blowing up. I had 1,800 followers in September of last year. I am about to cross 11,000 this month. And so, you know, it's been meteoric growth. You know, one of the first tweets that I had kind of take off was, you know, I basically tweeted about a $10 million business jet. I had an account reach out to me with 1 million followers and said, I thought that 45 million was kind of the get-in price. I was like, well, yeah, if you want to get a brand new Gulfstream G650, yeah, that's the get-in price. But, you know, there's a whole world of business and private aviation that exists. And the other thing is it's a taboo subject to talk about. You're not going to see, there are very, very, very large accounts that are on Twitter that I know their tail numbers. They own airplanes, but they have told me privately, look, I'm never going to tweet about my airplane, but let me tell you exactly what it unlocks for my business. And I kind of collect, you know, I collect some of those comments and I say, look, you know, this is what it means to fly private. This is, you know, good experiences people have. This is bad experiences people have. And I started writing a newsletter. Gosh, it was funny. I was literally in the Delta Sky Club, which is an ironic place to start a newsletter about private aviation. You'd think like, oh, I was in the back of a private jet. And I literally tweeted out, I was like, hey, if I started a newsletter talking about private aviation, would you subscribe? And I had 45 responses in like an hour, everybody saying yes. And I went through and looked at the people who voted yes. And I'm like, okay, based off of what I know about their business, they actually probably are liquid enough or do have a business use case for private aviation. So I started writing it mostly so that when people send me a DM, I just have them an article to send to them and say, hey, just read this. As opposed to answering the same question, I was answering the same question 4 or 5 times a week. And so I, you know, started writing that, and it's yielded some fruit for business, which is really cool. I mean, you know, it's something that I don't think I expected early on, but, you know, I've been able to have conversations with private equity and family offices and, you know, CEOs of large, you know, roll-up companies and large real estate developers. And so, you know, it's been a really cool journey. It's been a wild ride. I've really enjoyed it. And, you know, having the conversations with people has always been a lot of fun.
I love that. And I think you said something that is the secret of why your posts are so compelling. And that is, most people view this and it's this opaque industry and you don't really know anything about it. So the assumption is, I need to have the financial ability to spend $40 million on a jet. And if you are listening to this and you don't follow Preston right now, Preston, I love all of the different case studies you do where you just dive into, hey, this is, you know, maybe this is a $10 million jet. But then you have endless threads on jets that are 3 million, 4 million, or just planes, single prop or double engine planes that are 800,000, 1 to 2 million. And so the get-in price can be significantly lower than what much of the public realizes. And then you can, you know, finance that over 10 or 20 years. And so that really leads into this topic of what exactly, when does the typical person begin to explore private jet or private plane?
When I talk to people, you know, and I do free 15-minute subscriber calls for people who subscribe to my newsletter, but you kind of have the, call it the 50 hour and less. Everything in private aviation is measured in terms of hours, right? You don't buy an airplane ticket based off of how many miles you're going. You do it based off how many hours you're in the air, right? And fractions of hours that, you know, therefore. It's all on a basis of time. So if you're flying under, you know, call it 50 hours or less, maybe, you know, creeping into the 100 hours or less, it really doesn't make sense to own your own airplane when you look at kind of your all-in hourly cost by the time you pay hangar and insurance and maintenance and jet management and what have you. You're really going to net out and charter one-off chartering, kind of on-demand chartering usually works out better for you. Maybe a jet card. I have my own personal opinion on jet cards that, you know, most of it's a convenience thing. It's not really, you're not really saving money at the end of the day on a jet card. Then you have kind of fractional ownership. This is like, if you ever hear somebody say my NetJet share, right? Or on my NetJet's plane or whatever, you buy a sliver of the airplane that gets you a certain amount of access flying around owner cost, maybe owner cost plus 20%. And then you have, you know, so that's good for, you know, call it 150 hours, you know, 75 to 150 hours. After you cross over in 150 hours, you know, sharing a jet, right? I helped a CEO of a, you know, pretty mid-major company, you know, talking about him and another principal that he knew at another business, they shared, right? So they split it 50-50. All the fixed costs are split 50-50. They, you know, try and share it relatively 50-50, but pretty much, you know, whenever somebody needs to go, they go. So that's usually, you know, called the 150 hour mark. If you're flying 300 hours or more, it's more cost effective, especially when you start talking about tax advantages and things like that, to actually own the airplane. So if you're flying 300-400 hours a year, you know, you think about, you know, your large corporations, right? There's a reason why a lot of them own or have a corporate flight department, right? And they have an entire fleet of airplanes because, you know, those things are flying 400-500 hours a year. And so it just makes more sense from an hourly basis. But, you know, if you're talking about regularly utilizing private aviation, we're usually seeing net worth range somewhere in the $10 million range is kind of the starting point. You know, but again, like you said, right? That's, you know, if you want to say the word jet, right? That you know, it's funny. I have these covers, and if you're watching on video, you'll see what I'm pointing to. If you're not, I'll kind of describe what it is. But this is a Vision Jet right here, is on the cover of Flying Magazine. Get in price on one of those is less than $3 million. You can get them on the used market for two and some change. And then these are, you know, small single engine pistons that you can pick up for $200,000 or $300,000, kind of dependent on how old you're okay going. And so the net worth range is very relative there, right? But, you know, you want to talk about, I'm going to buy a jet or I'm going to buy a turboprop, right? You're buying $1 million TBM 700 is a really good example for a Texas specific airplane. It's a fantastic use case for Texas. You know, it's got a range of, call it 800 nautical miles, which means you can get anywhere in Texas, no stops. You know, four seats in the back, two seats in the front. So, you know, you and a couple of others, you know, can get somewhere quickly. You know, you get into one of those for $1 million and some change. Those types of net worths, you know, probably in the $6-8 million range. I mean, it just kind of depends on, you know, this is not financial advice. And frankly, you know, somebody like you, Justin, are more, you know, apt to kind of give that advice of like, how much of your net worth should you be spending if it's for personal, if it's business, the equation totally flips and inverts. But yeah, that's kind of where we see people getting into it, but it's not, you know, it's not, I have to have $100 million net worth before I ever even think about getting on a private jet. It's definitely not that.
Okay. That's super helpful. I am interested, you know, obviously there's tax benefits. If you're a business owner and you're purchasing a plane, that can be a significant expense, and it could be an asset where depreciation comes into play. So there's a lot of moving parts on the tax aspect. Can you dive in a little bit on the kind of rentability charter aspect? So you purchase, you know, let's say a $2 or $4 or $6 million plane or jet. How much are those annual costs going to be? And then how much in a best case or average case scenario can those be offset with chartering it out to others?
Let me explain to you kind of how the charter ecosystem works if you're an aircraft owner, and then we'll kind of back into some of the costs. So if you own an airplane, you put on a charter certificate. I'll give you an example. There's a company based in Dallas, you know, just down the street from you, called Leviate Air Group. They have a Part 135 certificate. They have an aircraft management division, and they will place demand into your supply, right? So they act as a broker, kind of as the in-between. And there is multiple layers of ecosystem here before you actually get to the owner of the airplane. So you have your charter brokers. They're going to charge somewhere between 3% and 7% premium to go source the supply for you. So you say, you know, you call up your broker and you say, hey, I need to go from, you know, Fort Worth to LA. I need to go on Tuesday and I need to bring 6 people. They say, okay, cool. Let me go get you a couple options. They go source the actual operator. In the event that something goes wrong, the advantage that you get with a charter broker like that, something goes wrong, it's on them. It's not necessarily on you. And so, you know, so that's the first part of the ecosystem and, you know, optional to use a broker or not. Then you have the aircraft management company. They actually hire the pilots for you, do all of the HR, kind of your outsourced flight department, right? We're talking about, you know, Walmart or, you know, Home Depot, Clayton Homes, they all have corporate flight departments to do all that management for them in-house. This is kind of your outsourced, you know, aircraft management group. So you pay them a flat monthly fee for those services. You know, it can range from, you know, $6,500 a month just for the management to, you know, up to 20,000, kind of dependent on the complexity of the airplane and a lot of those kinds of things. Then the next part of the ecosystem, right, is for them to actually fly your jet out on a charter, they take a revenue share. So different companies structure this a little bit differently. Some go lower flat fee, higher revenue share. Others do lower revenue share, higher flat fee. I always suggest to people, take the ones that do the higher revenue share because it puts the incentive on them to actually put demand into your airplane. So there's a, call it an 80-20 split. That's pretty industry standard. So 80% goes to the owner, 20% to the management company. And then that's what the owner actually sees. Out of that, the owner has to pay fuel, maintenance, you know, oil changes, right? Things like that, programs, if it's on an insurance program, insurance, hangar space, et cetera. I don't know how your audience feels about TikTok or Instagram Reels, but there's a lot of really bad advice out there that says, hey, I fly my plane for free because it charters all the times that I'm not using it. If you think about that entire value chain that I just said, a $12,000 trip or a $12,000 per hour trip, the owner might see, if he's lucky, $6,500, right, an hour. And at $6,500 an hour, it's going to cost them about $3,500 an hour to fly it. So they're making $3,000 per hour of contribution margin. That's got to go pay for hangar insurance. You know, hangar fees are $2,000 a month a lot of times. So, you know, you got 24,000. So, you know what, you know, the quick math says I've got to fly, you know, 8 hours a year to pay for the hangar. I got to fly 20 hours a year for the insurance. I got to fly, and then the management fee. So out of the gate, I got to fly 10 hours a month just to cover my management fee and the split and the rev share and all that, right? So it's really, really, really challenging to make an aircraft cash flow it's not even cash flow, it's contribution margin to be able to fly at some sort of a discounted rate. Your best bet is, you know, if you're going to put your aircraft on charter, you may offset most, if not all, of your fixed costs, depending on how much margin you can get, right? And then you're going to pay when you fly at cost. So you know, maybe if it costs $1,800 an hour to fly your airplane, which is about what it costs to fly a CJ4, for instance, when you get on the airplane, you pay $1,800 an hour and then everything else is covered. That's kind of best case scenario. You also want to pick what I call the aircraft that have, you know, kind of this charter demand to operating cost spread. The demand's so high that you can raise the price, but the operating cost is low, that spread starts to increase. So the Citation XLS is a great example of that. It's really cheap to fly, but to charter it, it's a high dollar charter. And so that's a great airplane. The Lear 45 XR series, for what you can get in the open market on charter, it's relatively cheap to operate. So, you know, there's a couple of aircraft like that make sense.
What's the get-in price on those two aircrafts?
Get-in price on an XLS today is going to be 8.5 was the last one that I looked at. And that's going to be something a little older. Sub 10, most likely, unless you're going to get something that's pretty new. Lear 45, you can get into today for under five. If you go a little older, 5.5, 6 is going to be market, right? For something that's got a lot of life left on it. So, you know, it's not a $45 million G650 again, right? But it also doesn't cost, you know, the 650 costs $4,500 an hour to fly, period. Don't care where you are, how much fuel is, right? Those may be more palatable for, you know, a high net worth individual, right? That wants to, you know, offset some of their use of it with charter.
That makes a lot of sense. What would you say are the biggest innovations happening in private aviation over the next decade that you're most excited about?
For me personally, a lot of it's about propulsion, right? At the end of the day, you cannot break the laws of physics. That is the one thing that you cannot break. But, you know, your audience will be very familiar with propulsion technologies and you know, what type of fuel are we using? Me personally, like, look, here's the deal. I am very pro oil and gas, and I'm not just saying that because I'm on an oil and gas podcast, right? But I work in private aviation, right? Jet fuel literally fuels, you know, what I do. Or 100 low lead, right? If it's on the piston side. And we still have leaded fuel. We're trying to get rid of it in the general aviation space, but there was some not great news that came out last week from a University of North Dakota study that they're going back to the lead. But, you know, I think sustainable aviation fuel is really exciting. Nestle, British Petroleum, World Fuel, a couple of those are kind of leading the way on that. I think the reality is, and this is something that, you know, you know, we have aviation media and everybody's rah, rah, sustainable aviation fuel. This is great. At the end of the day, like, there's like a fraction of a percent of overall jet fuel that's being produced as sustainable aviation fuel. So it's a bit press releasey right now. And to get the infrastructure to get there, and it's expensive. I mean, it is not less expensive to produce. And, you know, that is a driver of inflation. So we need some innovation to happen in that space before I get totally bought in and say, hey, this is, you know, the ultimate end game for, you know, for business aviation. I think a really exciting one for me is actually regional air mobility. So if anybody's, you know, at all familiar with kind of Joby and eVTOLs and, hey, we're all going to have flying cars and flying taxis. I mean, that I'm excited about that. I'm not even sure I'm 30 years old. I'm not sure I'm actually going to see it in my lifetime, transparently. And definitely not at scale. I'm excited about regional air mobility and the combination of that and hydrogen powered mid, you know, call it mid-range flights, right? So under 1,000 nautical miles, hydrogen powered. Never is a strong statement, but I very highly doubt we're ever going to cross any oceans not on jet fuel. From what I understand about the physics, I just don't see it happening. But for, you know, Fort Worth to Houston, that's a great use case for hydrogen, right? Because it's longer than the range of batteries. And here's a little bit of a tangent, but, you know, executives at oil and gas, this might be something that they might find interesting. Here's the problem. And the next time that you're at a country club and everybody's talking about, oh, electric propulsion, remind them of this. There are three forces of flight. There is lift, there is drag, and there is gravity, right? Those are three of the forces of flight. Gravity being a big component of that. What happens when you burn fuel? You get lighter. So you are producing thrust while simultaneously getting lighter over time. Electric batteries do not get lighter. It is a straight line. They are heavy if they're full, they're heavy if they're light. And as you hit the end of the power curve, at the end of the life of one of those batteries, you're actually exponentially decreasing the amount of thrust that you're able to produce because the weight hasn't lightened. So if you're flying in an airplane and you have half fuel tanks and by the end you have an eighth of a fuel tank, you are lighter when you land than when you took off. That is, you know, pretty basic math. In electric propulsion, that doesn't happen. And that may not be a big problem for cars because if a battery dies in a Tesla, you just pull off to the side of the road. If the battery dies in your airplane, you hit the side of the road, but not in a way that you actually intended to.
That's an incredible point. So I want you to repeat something. Did you just say that an electric battery in an airplane could not even facilitate Fort Worth to Houston? That is a very small trip.
Yeah. You know, look, we haven't seen a whole lot of them flying around, right?
Yeah, for good reason.
So, you know, you haven't, if you look up overhead, you're not seeing a whole lot of electric powered aircraft going. It, you know, in a perfect world, it's about an hour of flight time that you get. But, you know, a lot of these manufacturers are quoting, right, we're going to go, you know, downtown New York City to JFK. It's not very far, right? It's a whole lot closer than, you know, Fort Worth to Houston. And that's where I think that hydrogen power comes into play, because you have you for the first time in aviation's history, you have we'll call it the, you know, recent history, right? 50 years. You have an opportunity for your cost of incremental thrust and incremental lift to decrease exponentially, right? Because hydrogen power, from how I understand it, and I am not an engineer, but from how I understand it, hydrogen power has an opportunity to exponentially get cheaper as we kind of figure out unlocks of how that propulsion mechanism works. And, you know, you got to think in the same way with a car, right, where you're turning wheels, we are turning a big blade in the air that's pushing air over it. So there is an opportunity to have an exponential decrease in the cost of lift, which is going to unlock these types of regional trips, call it 9 seats or less. And it's going to, if there's a chance to democratize aviation, Wheels Up likes to use that term a lot. Hydrogen, we have to get the cost out of the fuel. It is the number one driver of cost when you're flying through the air. We have to get that cost down. And I don't see, and you know, your listeners, I would love to hear if this is going to be incorrect, but if we see an exponential drop off in the price of jet fuel, like the whole world economy is going to collapse, right? It's not going to be good for the, you know, for oil and gas and all of that to exponentially drop. But if for those, call it those short trips, we do have the opportunity to have a replacement in the hydrogen space. That's where I think that there's a lot of really interesting, and the companies that I'm most excited about are focusing on that. They're saying, look, it's autonomous flight, yes, but it's also short regional hops. I mean, I live in Chattanooga. Chattanooga to Miami, in the grand scheme of things, not that far, right? But right now, a commercial airliner, I've got to go through Atlanta to go to Miami. If I'm on a jet, I'm going to be flying, you know, hour and a half, 2 hours. But if I'm burning $900 an hour or $1,800 an hour worth of jet fuel, you know, there's no chance that that's going to be unlocked to, call it, the everyday person. And that's what I'm most excited about personally, is kind of the regional air mobility, as somebody who doesn't have American Airlines in my backyard like you guys do.
Yeah. Absolutely. Appreciate the kind words for oil and gas there. And it is funny how much attention headlines can grab, even though an alternative fuel source is maybe taking up just a minuscule, tiny fraction of what's actually necessary, which is, you know, again, a reminder that oil and gas are miracle natural resources that have made life infinitely better for billions of people. Certainly, aviation is at the front and center of industries dependent on it. I'd love to pivot a little bit and just really get your thoughts, break it down for us in terms of how do you analyze whether it's better for someone to do net jets or actually buy an aircraft themselves and the responsibilities that go with that. And maybe part two of that question is, okay, you want to do, is it jet card? Is that the right term? And how do you compare kind of net jets, Wheels Up, and other alternatives?
Yeah. So, you know, we talked earlier about what the profile looks like for the individuals who are doing that, but there are these overlap points, right? If you're flying 50 hours a week or 50 hours a year, don't buy an airplane unless you just really want one. 50 hours a year is not enough utilization. And that's, you know, 25 2-hour trips. That's not enough utilization to own the entire airplane by the time you talk about all those fixed costs. If you're not going to charter it, right? You know, if you want to try and charter it, you're taking on some risk. What we see primarily, and I'll speak really quick to kind of the business owner, because you have kind of two personas, right? You have the individual, which for the individual, frankly, because there is no depreciation benefit and there is no kind of cost of trip write-off, right, is just an after-tax expense. Like 99% of the time, chartering makes the most sense because it gives you the most amount of optionality. Here's the other thing that I think is an interesting nuance to this question, and I haven't talked about this a lot on other podcasts, so this is an exclusive insight to your audience. But if you think about optionality and you think about protecting for future downside risk, right? So you're saying, okay, you know, there is an odd in the future that everything crashes. There's an odd in the future that everything goes to the moon, right? And you're constantly thinking about what are those odds? If you own an airplane and you own it outright, you're paying those costs whether you like it or not, right? You're going to pay it next year if you know, the grid goes out. Well, if the grid goes out, right, you know, probably a lot bigger problems than figuring out what's up with the airplane. But you know, if the economy contracts by 20% because Jerome Powell gets crazy and says, hey, just kidding, no more interest rate cuts and, you know, whatever, right? You have a future liability and, you know, maybe the market resets, the airplane market resets, and now you're sitting in $5 million of real depreciation costs. That is cash depreciation cost. It's costing you a couple $100,000 a year. Guess what? In 2 years, tough luck, buddy. Right? Like you're stuck with it. You're going to pay it whether you do or not. When you charter, it is a one-off transaction. You can cancel if you want to, right? You can charter today and say, you know, I'm going to spend $40,000 on this trip and tomorrow I'm going to go ride an economy, right? And done, right? So for individuals, you know, I always suggest, look, you don't get any depreciation benefits unless it's something really sweet, like, you know, you and five or six other buddies are going to go in on a $3 million jet. And it's like, okay, you know, worst case scenario, you know, I still like to have the jet, right? You know, that's not a downside risk. But if you're buying a $12, $15, $20 million airplane as an individual, like you're taking on a whole lot of risk with very, very few tax incentivized, you know, structure to that purchase. So I usually suggest if you're an individual, just charter. If you're a business, that's kind of where it gets a little different. Now, on a fractional program, you know, I'll give you an example, right? So let's say, you know, we're talking about, you know, a company that has maybe three or four airplanes and they're trying to decide between I'm going to own three or four airplanes or I'm going to get a NetJets share. You have some complexity around the concept of kind of the lead passenger, right? So you can only have a finite amount of lead passengers in a lot of these programs. So let's say, you know, your CEO, COO, CFO all get lead passenger status. We only have three others. You have VP of leasing if you're in real estate or, you know, VP of real estate development, right, that needs access. You can run out of kind of primary passengers in that situation. You're also kind of buying capacity at a premium, right? So you're going to pay a premium even if you're on a NetJets share. You're going to pay a premium. Now, that's why you wouldn't buy a NetJets share as a multi-member, you know, unit. If it is just the principal flying, NetJets is a very, very viable option. If you have 8, 10, 12, 15 people that each need to be able to fly at any given time at the drop of a hat to go somewhere, NetJets may not be the right option for you, frankly, because it can be cumbersome to administer on your side. You know, yes, you have NetJets representatives, and yes, it's very nice. You have concierge service, all that. But, you know, if you, you know, hit halfway through the year and you go, wow, we've used up all of our hours, all of our time, you're going to come out of pocket for it, right? And that not great, right? So, you know, that's why you wouldn't. Why you would is it is stress-free, hassle-free. There is, relatively speaking, right? I've got a few clients and a few friends that all fly NetJets, and they're like, look, I pick up the phone. I say, here's where I'm going. The airplane shows up. The pilots are professional. They're nice. You know, they get me to where I'm going. It's always safe. NetJets has never had a fatal accident. So there is some value in that. It just takes a lot of the stress off. I have a follower on Twitter that sent me a DM. She manages aircraft for her, you know, husband's family office, family business. They own a Citation CJ3. And they have a Phenom 300 on order. And they've decided, we're done with this. We're dumping the airplanes. We're getting a NetJets card and we're calling it a day. Because they're tired of a lot of the hassle, right? You have aircraft on ground and you have if you're publicly traded, right, you know, you have balance sheet liability. I mean, you know, that is a real thing. If you are publicly traded, there is scrutiny. I heard a funny story that when Ford during the automotive bailouts, Ford dumped their fleet of, I think, G450s and G550s into the market and bought a bunch of fractional shares. They were getting pressure. They were kind of getting fiduciary pressure from shareholders and activists saying, hey, why is Ford getting all this money from the government and they have all these jets? So they dumped them, bought a bunch of NetJet shares and like tripled their corporate aviation expense.
And it's harder to link back. It looks better publicly, even though it's a ridiculous decision.
Right, exactly.
And it's funny you mentioned that. We have a client who took a very similar path, business owned planes. And then there's a situation where the main pilot eventually retires. And you get into this scenario where you're thinking, oh my gosh, this is all of the sudden the single most important decision that I'm going to make in the next 25 years. Who am I going to hire to fly my family? And the end result of that is, you know what? It's just easier to sell the planes and get a subscription service that just takes all of the responsibility off of our shoulders. I would love to end with this. You know, it makes a lot of sense if you own a business. There's so many ways that you can approach this. And it's a little bit easier. But let's say that you're in a situation where you've been at a super major for 30 years, you're at kind of a VP or executive level, and you're heading into retirement with $20, $30 million. How would you tell someone like that to think about private aviation if they want to pursue private aviation?
Yeah, so it's funny that you mentioned that. I was at a conference about a year and a half ago with a CEO of a super major, and I didn't even realize who he was when I was standing in the back of this conference room. And I looked over and I said, "Hey, how's it going?" And you know, we started talking. And he said, "What do you do?" I said, "I work in private aviation." He goes, "Cool." And I looked at his name tag and I look over, realize who he is, and I was like, "Oh, okay, you know private aviation. You probably actually know it better than I do." And he said, "Look, I have had at my disposal for my entire professional life a fleet of airplanes that I can snap my fingers and I get on and I go anywhere that I want to in the world." He said, "I'm about to retire and I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to do when it comes to, you know, travel." And he said for himself what he was going to do, because you know he was, as most of these guys are, a good old boy who, you know, liked to have fun. And he said, "I'm going to get me one of those SR-22s, the Cirrus SR-22s. I'm going to go learn how to fly, and I'm going to fly myself around. I'm going to enjoy retirement. I'm going to fly all around the Midwest and, you know, putter around." And he said, "Eventually, I might upgrade into a Vision jet." If that's your risk profile and that's your risk tolerance, is a very viable entry point into aviation, right? Your get-in price, you're going to pay about $1 million for an SR-20 and brand new SR-22. Oh, and by the way, you're going to wait like 18 months to take delivery of it. That's a bummer, but it's the nature of the beast. But you take delivery of one of those, what, they cost less than $400 an hour to fly them. They're really cheap, relatively speaking, to fly. You can get most anywhere. If you live regionally, right? If you live in California, you want to get up and down the coast, you know, easy. I don't know why you'd go retire in California personally. This is not tax or financial advice, but that seems like a backwards tax move. But hey, come to Tennessee, where we don't have state income tax. You retire here. I'm in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I can, in an SR-22, I can be in Nashville, Charlotte, Atlanta, Tallahassee, Columbus. I can be in Milwaukee. I have done this trip in an SR-22, Chattanooga to Milwaukee in 2.5 hours, 3 hours if you get vectored around, right? So it's, you know, it unlocks that for you if that's your risk profile. If not, if that's not you, if you're retiring and you say, "Look, private aviation is a way of life for me and my family. It's something that we've gotten used to." I'd look at a jet card subscription. I would look at, you know, Wheels Up has been through some turmoil in the last 24 months. I would subscribe to Wheels Up or a program like it that services your area. Volato has a really good program on the Honda Jet where you fly for, you know, $5,000 or $6,000 an hour. And if you're doing it, you know, 12 times a year to go see the grandkids or whatever, or go see kids at college, it's a really viable option for those people that have, you know, some sort of wealth that they've accumulated. They've worked really hard and, you know, why not enjoy it a little bit?
That's fantastic. I love it. Well, Preston, thanks so much for coming on. And we're going to link your X or Twitter profile, as well as a link to your newsletter. Is there anywhere else where people can find you?
Yeah, you can find us at flyingfinance.com. Really simple. That's the company that I'm with, flyingmag.com, aircraftforsale.com, avbuyer.com. We can link, we've got like 28 websites that we can link below if you've got the link capacity. But yeah, you know, come, if you subscribe to my newsletter, there's an option for a 15-minute free consultation that you can, we jump on the phone and basically for 15 minutes, you can pick my brain and it's worth as much as you pay for it, which is free. So it's free advice, but it's also worth about that much. But I can help point you in the right direction, help uncover some things for you, you know, help frame some of your thinking if that's what you need. So looking forward to connecting with anybody and everybody. I am, for the time being, I am very approachable. I think my DMs are starting to get a little cluttered, but I can usually pick out the people, the people that are worth the conversation. So.
Absolutely. Well, yes, I can endorse it. Wonderful 15-minute call. Super helpful. And Preston, thanks so much for coming on the show. If you have any questions for us at FPOG or ideas for future episodes, send us a message. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. You can subscribe or connect with us at brownleewealthmanagement.com or send ideas for future episodes to podcast@brownleewealthmanagement.com. Thanks, and we'll see you next time. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed during this show or episode should be viewed as investment, legal, and tax advice. If you have questions pertaining to your specific situation, please consult the appropriate qualified professional.